from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Last year, 15-year-old Shante Daniels of Oakland was shot and killed by a 14-year-old he'd apparently teased. One more young person killed, one more young person accused of killing. As the nation debates what to do about gun violence, we turn to an innovative program now being introduced into the Oakland schools that attempts to do something very basic, encourage kindness. One of the programs involves bringing infants into the classroom to give kids a chance to relate to someone vulnerable. Can kindness be taught? Can programs like this reduce aggressive and violent behavior? Some answers next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In the wake of the Newtown tragedy, it's sometimes forgotten how many kids are killed not in mass shootings, but one by one in the streets and in the neighborhoods of America's cities. 12% of Oakland's homicide victims have been children. Nearly 50 kids have been killed there in the past 4 years. As the nation continues to debate what to do about gun violence, we turn our attention in this edition of Forum this morning to a school initiative designed to reduce aggressive behavior in schools in Oakland and elsewhere. It's called Social Emotional Learning, and its goal is to improve social and emotional competence. Among the techniques, utilizing a pioneering Canadian program called Roots of Empathy that teaches empathy to children by bringing infants into the classroom. Joining us for our conversation this morning, Dr. Tony Smith. He's superintendent of the Oakland Unified School District. Tony Smith, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Mary Gordon. She's the founder and president of that Canadian organization, Roots of Empathy. Mary Gordon, good morning.
Good morning.
And here, too, is Vicky Zakchevsky. She's the education director of Greater Good Science Center at the University of California, Berkeley, which studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being. Good morning as well, Vicky.
Good morning.
Happy to have you all join us. Let's begin by some definitions. When you hear a word like social and emotional learning, Tony Smith, or the teaching of empathy, it can sound sort of soft, sort of woo-woo sort of stuff. What is it exactly? Why is it important?
I think it's essential. We're helping young people and adults develop the fundamental skills for being effective in life. You know, we talk a lot about being college, career, and community ready. We have to be able to understand our own experiences emotionally to have a better relationship with others in the world, and also to engage deeply in dialogue, to take other people's perspectives and to examine our own. It's not simply about the emotional over here and the soft. It's actually always part of a whole approach to the world, and the socio-academic is always bound together.
Give me a concrete example, what that means in a classroom, why it's important for a kid, particularly a kid who may grow up in a tough, challenging neighborhood in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about something like a social filter, that I have a strong response to something somebody said. If I just shout out my immediate response or I'm talking over somebody, that doesn't actually create the conditions for a thoughtful dialogue, that my ability to hold my own responses and to think through what I'm feeling and to be able to observe that actually makes me a more full participant and, over the long haul, more socially successful. So it's both academic in the sense of listening longer and having the capacity to hear the other, but also to then be in better relationship over time.
And what do we know about the need for this? If kids have grown up in tough circumstance, if they've been witness to violence in their home neighborhoods, what do we know about how that impacts how well they do in school?
Well, there's extraordinary trauma. I mean, there's a tremendous need for healing. And we've taken on the approach not just of full-service community schools, but we said we need to be a full-service community district to be able to coordinate, align, and leverage all the resources in the community for the well-being of children. And the immense impact of trauma, particularly in Oakland, not just on the kids, but the adults, we're having to be in dialogue and the kinds of processing and healing that's necessary for the city to get healthier, we think happens deeply in schools, and we need to take responsibility for that. It's something we all need to be working on all the time.
Tony Smith, superintendent of the Oakland Unified School District. Let's dig down then specifically into what these programs are, what they're designed to do, what they can accomplish. Mary Gordon, again, president and founder of Roots of Empathy, the Canadian program that's gotten so much attention, particularly for one aspect of what your program does, which is to bring infants into the classroom, and that is now being done in Oakland. Why do that? What does it accomplish?
The big bonus of bringing a baby and a parent into the classroom is that the children find the humanity in the baby, in the vulnerability of the baby. And the Roots of Empathy instructor coaches the children in observing and identifying what the baby's intentions are and what the baby's feeling, so that everything that happens around this little baby and the children sit around a green blanket with the family is a launching pad for the children to apply the understanding of emotion and perspective taking that they've learned through this little baby to themselves, and then the bridge to understanding how their classmates feel and what their perspectives are is what empathy is about, understanding that.
What happens when you bring that infant into a classroom? If they're a group of 8-year-olds standing around that infant, what do you hear? What do you see? What goes on?
Well, initially, we have a class before the baby comes every time in preparation, the week before. And the children have very specific questions that they've thought about. And there's a theme for each month, basically. So the children ask the mother. It's usually the mother. Sometimes we've got some dads in Oakland who are coming, and that's great for male nurturance. But they have very specific questions like, did the baby learn to turn over yet? Because the baby was trying so hard to turn over, and how very frustrating that must be. So they have practical questions, but they also have very insightful questions like, how do you feel when baby Job won't stop crying? So they are really learning the perspective of the challenges of parenting and the joys of parenting, and they're learning to ask questions. And in a democracy, children need to learn to ask questions so that they can challenge injustice, so they can speak up for what's right and fair. And the children are absolutely brilliant in this. Sometimes I call the program a pedagogy of hope, because the children are 100% of our hope for the future.
And is the purpose also in part to sort of melt the tough kids, that even the kids who are already tough and aggressive at a young age just are no match, you know, for an infant?
Yeah. Well, I think it's not just geared at the children who are identified as being aggressive already. It's universal in that it's for every child. We can all ramp up our empathy a little bit. But what we do find is that there is a huge impact on the children who are identified as aggressive.
And tell us what that impact is, because this has been very thoroughly researched.
Yes. Basically, if you look at it this way, when empathy goes up, aggression goes down. And when you look at the various forms of aggression, bullying is considered in that, and any kind of marginalization or cruelty. And the thesis is that when children come to understand how others feel, they realize that what they do or say or fail to do or say hurts somebody. And it's not a guarantee that they won't do it, but knowledge of how the other person will feel is a break against violence and aggression. And that is a simple way of looking at it. But the children develop emotional literacy. They can talk about their feelings. And much of the violence we see is deep, profound frustration and alienation, the inability to connect purposefully to others. And that is one of the things that Roots of Empathy is credited with doing in helping children form relationships that are meaningful.
And as I understand it, it's shown in the places where this has been studied, there's been as much as a 90% reduction in the amount of bullying that goes on. Is that correct?
The longest study, the longitudinal study, reported a 50% reduction in physical fights. And various studies have given various firms. But the one I am most impressed with is what happens over a 3-year period after the children have had the program, when they looked at all the different ages of children who had it. So they followed them from kindergarten to grade 8. So that is a substantial, sustainable achievement of the program, that not only did the aggression stay down, but the social and emotional understanding, which is what we're really looking at here, It even continued to improve. So this one shot over a school year gives children the internal resilience and strength to move ahead with all the things that they've been practicing.
We're joined now by a teacher and a student who have gone through this program, and we want to get their views on the difference that it made. Maren Jacobson teaches at Glenview Elementary School in Oakland, where Lynette Richardson is also a student. She's a fourth grader, went through the program last year as a third grader. Maren Jacobson, tell us what you witnessed when the infants were brought into your classroom.
Oh, well, there was just an incredible bond that happened, and they were so excited when, and anytime our baby hit a milestone, for example, when he started crawling, they would applaud, and they were just so excited. It was really amazing to see.
And did you see that in all your kids? I mean, whether they were kids who were doing well in school or not so well in school, was it a transformative effect across the board?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of these students were coming from different perspectives and different backgrounds, and I really noticed that having the baby in their classroom was such a galvanizing experience for them. It really created a bond and a community.
And let's speak, if we can, with your student, Lynette Richardson. Lynette, if...
Lynette is in a different area.
Oh, okay. All right.
Let me get you to her.
Okay, Lynette, if you're there as well on the phone with us, can you tell us what it was like for you? What you felt like when the baby came into your classroom last year?
Well, when the baby came in, it was really fun because it was exciting too. Because I mean, he could have a baby in your classroom during school.
Like, and how did it affect you? What did you wind up thinking about after you had seen that baby, touched that baby, watched that baby?
I felt like once I saw the baby, it was sort of something to look forward to. It was really fun. That was like the best part of my day.
What did your friends think of it? How did you guys talk about it? What did people feel about it when you had your conversations afterwards?
Well, after that, everybody was, like, super happy that we got to have a baby in our classroom. They thought it was really fun, except for a few people.
There are always a few, aren't there?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Lynette, thank you very much for being part of our program this morning and telling us about your experience. And thanks to your teacher, Maren Jacobson, at Glenview Elementary in Oakland. Let's turn now to... Vicky Zuchevsky, who is the director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. You hear these testimonials, Vicky, and you hear about the importance of all of this. But I can also imagine that there are parents out there saying, gee, this is swell, but gosh darn it, I want my kid to read. I want my child to learn what I think my child needs to know in order to progress. I don't want my child spending time just sort of ooh-oohing at a baby.
That is an argument that you hear quite often. However, science is starting to show that there, as Tony said, that there is a very strong integration between social emotional skills and learning. In fact, some scientists believe that cognitive achievement is 50% of the equation and social emotional skills are the other 50% of the equation.
And what do we know about what can actually be taught? I mean, can kindness be taught? Can empathy be taught? Is it something that you can take in the same way you take in learning how to multiply?
Yes, absolutely. Both kindness and empathy can be taught. Empathy is both affective and cognitive. So when I say cognitive, it means if you're walking down the street with your child, you can, and you see someone who may be hurting, you can say to your child, how do you think that person feels right now? And by affective, what I mean is it's actually trying to feel what the other person is feeling. And these are skills that science has shown can actually be taught.
And what are you seeing, Tony Smith, in your skill, in your schools now that's in these, as you've observed these programs getting started, do you have a sense of there being a difference? I mean, can you, this is, a soft question that demands not a very analytical, detailed, data-based answer, but do you feel a difference when you see these programs in action?
I think there really is a difference, and I would point to a specific in the hope part that Mary raised. The children actually begin to set goals for the baby, and they are planning for, and they write notes to the baby for the baby's future. So they're predicting that when the baby's coming in next time, will the baby have grown? What do we think their milestones will be? So there's a predictive capacity that's being built. But then there's a long-range hope and well-being dimension that they want this baby to have a great life. And so, the thing I would just offer there is that the opportunity to think through that for an other, for some of our young people who are in pretty incredibly distressed situations, that is a pathway to begin seeing that I could hope for myself.
So it's a direct connection to the idea that there is a tomorrow. I mean, that there is something that can be looked forward to.
Absolutely. And I mean, we know, I mean, just in terms of brain development, that capacity takes till about 23, like this whole future notion, future concept. But the sense of purpose and belief that we could have a positive future and to have a conversation about that, I mean, that is something I think is, you can get the feeling of that. But as young people are practicing that, that is a thought process that's building a sense of a muscle around that. That's a really important dimension to this, and that it establishes and maintains a positive relationship to self as much as to the baby.
Can you add to that, Mary Gordon?
Yeah, I think the whole idea of your question, can you be taught kindness or empathy? What Tony's referencing with the baby is that it's an experience. It's a lived, breathed experience. It's not just instruction, it's construction. And when little children have opportunities, as Vicky said, for someone to help them, guide them in taking the perspective of something that they're breathing and seeing, they develop the capacity to have the cognitive aspect of empathy, which is perspective taking. And if we can't get the other person, we can't feel for them. And the affective part, emotions, we don't really talk about emotions. And I think North America, no offense, is basically emotionally illiterate. And if we can raise a generation of little children who have the capacity to understand how they feel, to put a word on their frustration or their negative feelings, and then to be able to talk to others about it, that's emotional literacy. And that is growing in these 20 classrooms in Oakland.
Do we know whether or not this is something, Vicky Zekchevsky, that's going on psychologically? Is it going on biologically? I mean, do we know what's going on inside the brains of little kids?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So, for instance, we know that when children get anxious, their cortisol levels rise, and that actually causes confusion in their brain, so they can't think straight. So a lot of times when students have to take a test, they get very anxious about it.
Or even more basically, if you've gone through something traumatizing at home or in your neighborhood, that there's a biological effect to that?
There is, and there's a neurological effect as well. And they know that trauma actually causes damage to executive function, which scientists are now learning is an extremely crucial part to the learning process. And when I say executive function, I mean skills such as memory and self-control and decision-making.
And what do we know about how that's repairable and whether or not programs like this can have a restorative effect?
Well, the brain is amazingly malleable. We are learning by leaps and bounds that the brain can actually be rewired. So by giving students a safe place, a safe, caring classroom, it won't necessarily mitigate all of the trauma that they've experienced, but it will help them develop a secure attachment to the teacher. And they need that strong bond with a parent, with an adult, in order to feel safe to explore the world.
And you're studying this now at the University of Washington, right, Mary Gordon, about the way in which the brain may actually respond to these sorts of programs?
Yes, the program has been in Seattle for 7 years, and the iLabs are looking at both the structure of the brain and the functioning of the brain for children, 9-year-old children who have roots of empathy compared to 9-year-old children who don't have roots of empathy. And when they look at the structure of the brain, it's how has the brain physically been changed because of the muscle work, as Tony would say, that they're having in the classroom. But what's fascinating about the functioning of the brain, they are basically measuring emotional regulation. And the uptick of emotional ineptitude in society, and particularly the pain you're having now, is really about emotional irregulation gone crazy.
And so is part of the argument that you have to make, Tony Smith, as an educator, is that this isn't soft. It's actually hard. It's as hard as the wiring of your brain.
I think it's the most important work we need to do. And for example, we have a restorative justice framework in the district, and people often say, you know, we're moving away from zero tolerance to a restorative justice frame and to engage the conversation about how do you repair a relationship. And people say, well, that's soft. But when I sit with young people and watch this happen, the conversation, they are so uncomfortable and physically have to take responsibility and make amends and repair that relationship. That's some of the hardest work, and they've not necessarily been taught or had other experiences where they did that. So we think our commitment is to have a high-quality public school system that contributes to the health and well-being of the city. And I just would offer that we're part of the Collaborative for Academic and Social-Emotional Learning, which is a set of 8 districts across the country that are doing this work deeply on a research base, and Roger Weisberg and others have been really helping to put out into the public discourse that this is some of the most important and grounded work about becoming full human beings and having cognitive but also emotional capacity.
We want to open up our conversation now to all of our listeners, whether you'd like to email us at kqed.org, forum@kqed.org, or post your thoughts or comments on our Facebook page or on our website, or join us by phone at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this idea of teaching empathy and the importance of that, or perhaps you think the lack of importance of that in our schools. Along those lines, here's a comment that's already come in on our Facebook page. Eden writes, "This topic shocks me. We now have to teach children empathy. Is this not something children learn in preschool or in kindergarten? Are these children developmentally disabled? Are Oakland's children being raised to fend for themselves?" So that's the kind of feedback I suspect you sometimes hear, Tony Smith. Like, what in the world are you doing spending time on this?
Yeah, I think the analysis has to, though, start from the context and where we are. We live in a city that is structurally racialized. We have a city that's deeply divided by race and class and a history of embedded oppression, and there is extraordinary violence. That said, the work of actually building empathy is tied, when you talk nationally about the Common Core and introducing new content and actually aspiring to critical thinking for every child, this is work that we have to develop from preschool through 12th grade and college and beyond. The productive struggle, many of our young people, whether they're in affluent communities or not, don't have the capacity yet to struggle productively with other people around their ideas and not shut down if they're feeling uncomfortable, or to actually think about, maybe I can change my opinion without being embarrassed. There's a lot of work to do about building emotional capacity to be a deep thinker.
And yet, one article I read about these efforts, Vicky said the reporter asked the question of a teacher, well, this sounds to me like kids in your classroom aren't going to know how to read and write, but they'll know how to whine really well. what do you say in response to that?
Well, I would first start by responding that scientists are finding that we are actually wired for empathy from the time that we're very, very young. And so it is an innate sense in all of us. However, children have experiences that can be very traumatic. If they don't have that secure attachment with parent, then that can impact their ability to develop and cultivate that empathy.
And we'll pick up on more of that and take your comments as well. What do you think of this idea? Do you think it makes sense, or do you think it's a waste of time? How important is it to incorporate this kind of learning, emotional learning, into our schools? You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or post your thoughts or comments on our website or Facebook page. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, social and emotional learning and some new efforts taking place in the Oakland Unified Schools along those lines. Joining us to talk about it this hour, Tony Smith, the superintendent of the Oakland Schools, Mary Gordon, the founder and president of Roots of Empathy, a Canadian program originally that's now in tens of thousands of classrooms in North America, where infants are brought into the classroom as a way of developing relationships and empathy between kids and those vulnerable vulnerable young children. And Vicky Sachevsky joins us as well. She's the director of the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California, Berkeley. And we'd like you to join us, too, at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts and comments on our website as well. Let's go to a caller. Kathy in Cupertino joins us first. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi there. So as the I am the parent of an 18-year-old daughter who has high-functioning autism. She's graduated from high school with honors, and she's in college now, and she's majoring in public speaking. And it's very interesting because what your callers are describing is very, very similar to what we've had to teach our daughter over the years and what other parents of developmentally disabled kids who are high-functioning have to teach, which is how to recognize social cues, how to recognize that and translate it into or equate it to what they may be feeling, because these kids don't grow up with a natural ability to recognize that what they see happening in someone else relates to feelings that they may themselves have. They don't have a natural social vocabulary or emotional vocabulary.
Kathy, thanks. And, yeah, let me hold you there because it brings up an interesting parallel, and I'd like to get Mary Gordon's take on that. That hallmark of autism, that inability to relate or read social cues from other people, is that a relevant analogy to what's going on with kids in your programs as well?
Yes, the intentional, focused attention that the children have on the babies' facial expressions, their body language, and their vocalization helps the children read the cues of the baby. And of course, then that translates to reading the cues of one another. And we have many, many autistic children that we've heard from their parents that not only did the children gain these skills in the classes that they've been integrated into, but the children in the class opened up to include the autistic children who generally, any child who's perceived as being different is not included. And we have many stories of the families of autistic children saying that for the first time, their children have been invited to birthday parties because prior to that, they were not invited. The children only went to family birthday parties. And that is even a bigger milestone that we learn to include others mm-hmm. because we realize we all share the same feelings.
But also on this question of not being able to read cues, Tony Smith, is that something, I mean, that's very fundamental. And if you can't read that, if you can't really see what someone else is feeling or expressing, if you don't have that fundamental ability to process that, that's going to lead, I would think, often to aggressive behavior, if you can't pick up on what someone else is signaling. So is that part of what this gets at?
Absolutely. And in that regard, we're also working with the Developmental Studies Center, and we have a program called Caring School Communities that we've really worked to make this content really explicit and have young people sit in circles and actually begin to describe what they're experiencing, share with each other, talk about how they're processing, and then solving their own problems. I mean, if there are problems that they're experiencing in the classroom, on the yard, in the school, they solve them in the classroom and begin to build the skill set and the practice to read the cues and also, importantly, to do this work cross race, cross gender, cross class, to be able to be a full participant in community. I think we needed to go deeper in the schools, and we have built some structures to do that.
Are these programs, how available are they now in Oakland? Do they extend to some of the charter schools, for example, which are frequently schools that have some of the more challenged populations?
So we have, across the elementaries, we're doing Caring School Communities, Roots of Empathy. We're working in partnership with some of the charters. I don't know if all of the charters have access to these kinds of programs, but that's something we could definitely continue to work on.
And describe, can you paint a picture, Vicky, of what a classroom looks and sounds like that is conducive to this kind of learning? I mean, can you paint a picture of what a hospitable classroom looks and sounds like?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the most important part actually is the teacher. And we're just starting to learn that the social-emotional competency of teachers is crucial in developing a caring school classroom. And so a caring classroom is one where the teachers listen to the students, really listen to them, and they focus on what their needs are. They take the time to get to know the students as
individuals.
Sounds
obvious, but it's not.
It does, but it isn't. It's amazing. Yes, teachers don't necessarily go into the classroom having these social-emotional competencies. I mean, if you think about it, none of us learned how to function with social-emotional skills because psychology, this is an interesting tidbit, psychology just started to pay attention to emotions and the role in our lives in the latter half of the 20th century. And they didn't integrate social and emotional skills until the late 80s. So these are skills that none of us grew up with.
If I might real quick, there's a great example at Glenview, Jennifer Bouchard, who's a fifth grade teacher. And what this looks and sounds like, young people are managing the class. They're managing the content. They're engaging. They're raising the questions. Teacher really becomes content supporter and facilitator. And when the increase in social-emotional learning and support and capacity in young people, the teacher can facilitate very different kinds of work, and it becomes much more alive. Also, the young people bring in more of their outside experiences, and the content just gets richer in a class that's been supported like this.
Let's engage more of our callers in our conversation this morning. Lark joins us next in San Francisco. Lark, go ahead. You're on.
Good morning. Thank you. A couple of comments. My first is, I'm getting bad feedback. my first is, this brought back thoughts of quite a while back when I was in high school, and I went to what would be considered a pretty rough inner city school here in San Francisco. The majority of my schoolmates had been convicted of violent crimes, and that behavior was still going on. I myself was the recipient of it. And many of the girls had children. They were teenage moms, 15, 16. And I remember even as a kid, even as a teenager, thinking, wow, this is, these girls, my schoolmates here, are so violent, both verbally and physically, and they have these babies. And at times I saw them with their babies, whether it was, outside of school, and sometimes they were violent and sometimes they weren't. I'm wearing this really simplistically, but I'm assuming, I do think compassion can be taught, and I'm assuming they had not been taught compassion. Anyway, that's something that brought back. And then as another...
Just briefly, if you would, Lark, because we have lots of calls stacked up behind you. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. And the other brief one was, you mentioned, she just mentioned about the girl being invited to school, to the party. And in my elementary school, which was not a school like that, I remember that happened once to me, and of course your feelings are hurt, and that would have been really nice. So I'm wondering if this program works better in a school that's not like a super rough, violent inner-city school where maybe it's...
Okay, well, let's see if we can get some thoughts on that. Thanks, Lark, for raising that question. Is this something, Mary Gordon, that applies, and also Vicky Zhevsky, chime in on this too, that works regardless of the school, or are certain demographics more conducive to the effectiveness of these kinds of programs?
Well, the research on roots of empathy has taken place in rural, urban, suburban, isolated addresses, in 10 countries, in multiple languages, and in the most tortured neighborhoods and in the most privileged neighborhoods. And let me say, children are children are children. And that every child, as Vicky said, we are innately predisposed towards empathy. And given the chance, all children rise and will develop more empathy. It's just the starting point is different with some, so you wouldn't expect the same outcome, but I promise you the needle moves for every child.
So this isn't something that needs to be tailored, Vicky Zakchevsky, for particular schools, this is something that can work universally?
It can work universally. However, researchers have done studies to find out what makes a successful implementation of an SEL program. And what they found is that you have to have administrative buy-in and you have to have ongoing training of the teachers.
That's an interesting point. And I'm wondering how you're dealing with that, Tony Smith, about administrative buy-in. Any teacher will tell you how key it is to have a principal who's behind what you're doing. So do you have to work at selling this to principals who also feel pressure, I'm sure, to make sure their kids are doing well on STAR testing and all the rest?
It's been part of the conversation. I'm in my fourth year as superintendent in Oakland, and our entire vision is around becoming a full-service community district and about increasing the capacity to care for the whole child and the whole community. So this has been part of the conversation from the beginning since I've been there.
And do you find principals resisting, saying, hey, fine, Superintendent Smith, but what I'm judged on is how well my kids are going to do on state test scores?
In this regard, we're helped by the Common Core. Where we're headed and the kind of assessment that we're going to be expected to initiate with Smarter Balanced in 2015, we're going to be asking our kids to engage in some very different content. And people are seeing that we're going to have different kinds of classrooms. Mm. And in fact, many of the teachers are saying, oh, I get to teach again. And when you talk to a teacher, there's an excitement and an engagement and a way of saying, this is good teaching. This is what we should have been doing. And some of the way that No Child Left Behind kind of narrowed.
So do you think we're moving beyond the sort of teaching to test issues and the governor's new proposal that local districts have more control over how money gets spent? Are we moving to a different approach now?
I think we have to. I mean, this is about the deep investment in community and not just being a test score factory, but literally preparing young people. I mean, the opportunity that we should be providing is that, you know, career is the goal, learning is the path. And how, in fact, are we helping every young person access their full talents and gifts in relationship to content? That does take a lot of professional development, and it is a fundamental shift. And that's why I would say that it has to be held at the system. And I think in Oakland in particular, we have to have a healthy system to ensure the common good. This equity piece isn't just about programs or about other nonprofits. It's about the whole system has to hold the well-being of all the children.
Back to our calls. Deborah in Oakland is up next. Deborah, go ahead.
Hi. I've been a teacher in Oakland for 20 years, and actually I'm on a leave of absence, but going back next week. And I wanted to talk about what I think would work. I really love the idea of social-emotional learning. I'm wondering how it's being implemented at the high school level, because that's the level I work with, and how are parents being brought into the discussion? Because I really feel that without bringing the families in directly, maybe bringing them into the classrooms, it really has to be reinforced at home. And I also feel very strongly about the skills that we teach students in class, whether it's, you know, math skills or English or history, have to be totally integrated with the soft skills that they're going to need to interact with, you know, their coworkers, neighbors, you know, other members of their family, and so on. So I just want to say, you know, one of the earlier callers had said something about we have to teach this at school, and I feel as a teacher, yes, we must teach this at school. It seems really, really critical to me.
Thank you, Deborah. Any thoughts on how this can be implemented in the secondary level?
So I think part of the focus has to be on supporting teachers and the school with the counseling structures, but also the broader frame of restorative justice and actually encouraging.
Which means?
So the history has been really around discipline is about you broke a rule, you're excluded, as different than you ruptured a relationship, that you basically there's a human relationship here that was interrupted and that you're part of a larger community. So we're building that out in the high schools, and it's a transition. It's a change in the discipline structure. I think
you've had a lot of scrutiny in Oakland over suspensions in particular.
Absolutely, and this is part of our effort to interrupt that. And there's been a disproportionate suspension specifically for African-American boys, and they've been excluded at the highest rate. They make up about 17% of the population and suspended about 42%. So we have said we're building an awareness, listening, and learning campaign about hearing from folks, how could we do this? And we've gone specific. We have an African-American male achievement initiative specifically in manhood development in the high schools. We're working specifically with boys of color, naming this social-emotional learning piece.
And Vicky Sikchevsky, what do we know about how this can work with teens? You were talking earlier about the brain being malleable. Mm-hmm. How malleable are 16-year-olds? I mean, what can happen at that point?
Well, their brains are still developing, obviously. I think Tony had mentioned before that brain development goes on until 23. But we also know that the wiring of the brain can change throughout our entire lifetime. So even if you haven't developed these skills at a young age, you can still be taught actually through your whole life.
And to Lana next in Oakland. Lana, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my point is really one that I think the social-emotional direction that the school district is taking is the right one, I think, for the schools and for the community, and also to bridge the gap between the public and the charter schools. I feel that this is one of the large pulls that is taking students from the public schools and into the charter schools, which is a bit of a problem right now. What I want to know, though, is why are we holding the students liable? It seems to me that a lot of these programs are geared towards the students, and I feel like teachers are not being held accountable. As a parent of a student in the Oakland Unified School District, I have witnessed some horrific things from multiple teachers, just things that are being said, shame, blame. This punitive vein in our culture is so strong, and I feel like the teachers aren't being held accountable. They don't hit our kids, but the damage they're doing emotionally is proven to actually affect the same part of the brain that physical damage does. So sorry to get a little emotional on this.
Thank you, Lana, for raising it. Let's get the superintendent's response.
I think it's the whole organization. I think it's our responsibility to say we are going to hold each other and learn how to build the emotional capacity and caring capacity and do some healing, quite frankly, in the whole system. And we need to create examples and begin to describe what a caring, healthy classroom looks and feels like and support staff and each other to ensure that that's happening. I know that there are places where it's amazing and we have extraordinary examples of those positive classrooms, and other places where it's not. And we need to eliminate those, but we also need to hold this as an entire system and have that be our core expectation.
And is the system changing so that you have more ability to modify what teachers do, given the strong union protections for tenured employees?
So I think, again, the common core opportunity and what we've been able to do in Oakland is invite teachers and other educators to start to develop the content that we would be actually building curriculum again together. And in that, what are the student experiences? How are they engaging one another? And really modeling the kind of practices, the learning practice, building professional capital as different than holding just an individual accountable. How are we building professional learning communities for our staff?
Vicki Sekchester, you wanted to chime in?
I did. I wanted to chime in because I think that the caller brought up a very, very important point. And the focus of the social-emotional programs right now are on the students, but we do need to focus on the teachers. But we need to start earlier before they actually get into the classroom. We need to start when they are in teacher education, where they're learning how to be a teacher. And right now, teacher education doesn't have this kind of training at all in their programs.
Some emails and Facebook comments coming in. Sarah writes, this is fascinating, but in an academic testing obsessed government that refuses to adequately fund schools, I'm wondering where the funding comes from for this program. Superintendent Smith?
We've been really fortunate, whether it's the Novo Foundation, Bechtel, Kaiser, folks have really come forward and helped us. And Mary's extraordinary. We've done fundraising together. She's brought funding and support to the table. But there is really a national move to say we have not paid deep enough attention to the whole child, and funders are beginning to see that and move in this direction to support us. I think Mary could add to this.
Mary Gordon.
Yes, Tony. I just wanted to say that there is a wonderful sense in Oakland of hopefulness. And yesterday, in speaking with some of the teachers and some of the administrators, one of the sense that came up was we have to start to measure what we treasure. And there is a treasuring of children's whole lives, as Tony mentions. And I think that is really spring.
Marilyn in Marin joins us next. Marilyn, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher in Marin County, a high school teacher, and I'm getting my master's in education. My thesis is on this topic of teaching social-emotional learning at the secondary level. And my question today for the speakers is, I'm wondering what you feel the role of the teacher is in successfully implementing social-emotional learning programs, and whether or not do you think this should be taught in a teacher credential program to prepare them?
You were speaking just about that, about sort of getting this into schools of education.
Mm-hmm, right. Yes, exactly. I think what teachers can do now, if they're already in the classroom, is first they should reflect in their own lives in terms of where these skills are and where they may lack and start to work on developing them within themselves.
John tweets in, speaking as a former cop, this program makes sense and should be expanded to middle and high school. Casey writes, as the three R's get shoved down to lower and lower grades, preschools are stuck working on letters when they should be focused on social and emotional learning. My cooperative preschool was entirely focused on emotional development for my child's first child 10 years ago. They've now been forced to do more academics because of all the pressure. And Ingrid writes in, curious about the students that the girl mentioned who didn't like the baby visit. That goes back to Lynette, who spoke, our fourth grader. What kind of problems or resistance do the researchers see, and what methods do they use to work with them? What about those kids who just don't respond to those infants, Mary Gordon?
Well, I'd love to have a word with Lynette and find out more. So I can't really speak for the child, but I can tell you the little children, generally little boys, who feel that they ruin their macho image if they show any tenderness, generally come Christmas, they have all melted. And the gorgeous thing is that the tone of the classroom makes it okay to be tender and makes it okay to give wishes for the baby that are completely representative of how the child wishes their own life would be working out.
Dorian writes in, I think teaching kindness and empathy is a great idea. I'm a community college teacher and have worked with older adolescents. And I've noticed that while small kids are often willing to learn and be kind, lots of the important stuff we try to instill wears off as they gain life experience. Can you bring this program to older students as well? Can't recall, but one of you was making the comment that maybe it was before we went on the air, Mary Gordon, about there's been a decline of empathy in college students.
Yes, there's a study by Dr. Sarah Conrath out of the University of Michigan that's totally alarming. She aggregated a number of studies going back to the 70s where they were measuring empathy levels of university students, and there is a very steep decline in empathy. And it's interesting, you know, the reason I started Roots of Empathy was that I had been working for about a decade with violence, with child abuse and neglect and domestic violence and gratuitous violence. And I learned that the common denominator in all of that suffering was the absence of empathy. So I think to heal the blight of the violence we're experiencing now, we really need to look at what are the human capacities that we need to develop in young people so they don't go down that road.
Let's get in another caller. Susan joins us next in San Mateo. Susan.
Hello. Hi. I'm great. I'm glad to hear you're addressing this subject. Okay, here's my question. Right now there is software for enhancing cognitive functions. It's become very big. They call the overall heading brain fitness. What I want to know is if they're familiar with any software for enhancing empathy. So it would be tasks, and then the kids would choose answers to help build in empathy in the brain.
Great question. Vicki?
I do know that our own faculty advisor, Decker Keltner, and Mark Brackett out of Yale, who is the head of the RULER program, they are working together on trying to develop some sort of software that develops these skills.
I'd actually like the answer to be no.
This is one
arena where software doesn't work, where you actually need to have real human-to-human
connection. Dave, if I don't say something, I'll burst. And I know both of those people and respect both of them. So this is not, again, what they're saying. But let me tell you, we have children's lives. If you look at how they spend their time, so much of it is interacting with a screen. And the way you develop these human capacities is through human connection. And children's relationship skills have been decreased. Now, I'm not technophobic. I love technology. Great fun. But I think we have a responsibility to give children opportunities to interact with one another in playful ways. And here's where parents and schools look out for that. The reality is Christensen has predicted that by 2020, 50% of all school education will be computer-based. And if that's the case, boy, do you ever need these social-emotional programs yeah. that Vicky and Tony are speaking about to counter that direction.
It's here that I want to read this last Facebook posting as a way of getting just some last thoughts from all of you. This is from Roxanne, who says, I'm 26 years old. I work with youth and teen. I grew up in a very violent home in the Bay Area. My father beat my mother on a daily basis. And I believe that because of those experiences, I grew up wanting to protect children and help them grow up in a healthy environment. It's very important for us to teach students about their own emotional awareness. Sometimes I believe we need to teach other adults as well. So to prevent those experiences in the Roxannes of the future, what do we need to do, Vicky?
I think it's very important that we need to heighten the awareness of the importance of social and emotional learning, and we need to implement it not only in our schools, but as adults, we need to implement it in our lives as well, our personal and professional lives.
Mary Gordon.
I think we need to break intergenerational cycles of violence and poor parenting, and it's nobody's fault. Nobody wakes up in the morning and decides that they're going to beat their wife. It's a pattern that can be changed, and the children are the answer.
Roxanne overcame what she experienced, Tony Smith. How do you promote and develop more Roxannes?
I do think it's the entire system approach that you put the purposeful outcome that every child is healthy and well as a result of their time with us in the school district. We have a long way to go, but I think that the effort to increase our sense that we belong to each other and that we are in fact a community will heal the fracture. I think so much of the violence that we see in the community is because people don't feel like they are that connected. I think we have a chance to increase that connectivity.
I want to thank all of you for participating in our program this morning. Tony Smith, superintendent of the Oakland Schools, Mary Gordon, and the founder and president of Roots of Empathy, and Vicky Zakchevsky, the director of the Greater Good Science Center at the UC Berkeley. Thanks all very much for being in our program. I want to mention as well that tonight on This Week in Northern California, we'll have an interview with Governor Jerry Brown. That's tonight on KTVU Channel 9. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.